Welcome back to Do No Harm, everyone. On this episode, we'll be digging into environmental injustice and its effects on minoritized communities. Today, we're joined by a special guest, Justin J. Pearson, and he's an environmental justice advocate and activist out of Memphis, Tennessee. So Justin, if you want to give a one or two liner about you and your work, where you're from.
Fantastic. I am Justin J. Pearson. One of the co-founders of Memphis Community Against the Pipeline, which is a grassroots-led movement here in Memphis to fight environmental injustice by stopping the crude oil by Haley Connection pipeline from being built through one of our most vulnerable communities.
Great. Thank you for that intro, and thank you so much for joining and sharing with us all today. So a lot of what we'll talk about today has its roots in racial segregation and redlining. And redlining was a practice where mortgage lenders would essentially draw red lines around portions of a map to exclude Black communities from buying within those borders. And today you can see the direct effects of these policies after every single natural disaster. The trend will be low-income Black, Latinx, and Indigenous communities always face higher rates of economic and health losses compared to predominantly white affluent neighborhoods. And though these neighborhoods are the most affected by environmental injustices, they're also the most underfunded. So you see things like when disasters strike, response times are slower and the consequences of disaster last disproportionately longer. We've seen this with Hurricane Katrina, the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, and most recently with the winter storm Uri in the South. And so with this in mind, I kind of want to open it up to everyone here on any reflections you have on that or anything that you specifically want to ground our listeners in, whether it be from a historical or like terms people should know, things like that.
I think that's a wonderful prelude into the conversation because it shows how large and significant this history really is, that what we experience in the present is not in isolation. There have been decisions made in policy and in practice over the last several centuries that impact our very existence until this point. And so I think one is the conversation about environmental racism. This is the intersection, you would say, of fossil fuel infrastructure, of toxins or toxicity in the forms of not just pipelines, but the outputs and oil refineries and the like that are disproportionately placed in communities of color, whether that be Black folks, Indigenous folks, other people of color. Okay, that's an important definition for people to understand. I think you already explained the history of redlining, which is really important for people to realize, and also its connection to educational opportunities. And so because of the way our systems are designed based on property values, we will determine how much money goes to a school system. Okay. And so when you think about interlocking injustices that are starting to add up, and you all have done great work talking about health impacts, you have to talk about how education, home values, redlining, and then what is put inside of communities such as oil refineries has long-term amplifications for pollution, which has implications for healthcare access, and who's going to be spending more of their lives in hospitals versus not. The last thing I'll say before we dive deeper, these communities were created this way. People were placed in pockets within cities and towns and states and have been deprived of social, economic, political power to fight the injustices. Communities do not think that they are voiceless. Communities do not just think that they are powerless. This has been a very real attempt by government, a policy, by local practices to create communities where voices are marginalized, where people's power is dampened or hampered or restricted. And we're seeing that in some real ways in voting rights now. And so we have to look at the manifestation of that in cases like the one we have here in Memphis, or you could look at what's happening with Line 3 and other places across the country as a continuation of historical oppression. And we are all victims of it. And so it is important that we position ourselves as well within this context and within this story, because we all live somewhere. We all are someplace. And so we are not separate from the realities that very much so the air that we breathe has more or less toxins in it because of decisions that have been made. You can drink the water or you can't drink the water because someone has determined your life's value on whether or not you deserve to have clean water to drink or you do not. And those big ideas have real world implications in the here and now. And so I don't want all the definitions and the words that I use to separate us from the very real impact that each of us experience and face today.
That was so much great knowledge. Thank you. I think also something that I just want to emphasize going into this, I feel like especially recently environmental justice and activism surrounding the environment has been kind of a big thing in media. And I think it's really important that as we're going through the topics in this episode and as we're discussing all these different issues that we constantly kind of remind ourselves of who we're supporting and who we're rallying behind and who we've been rallying behind. And something that I think about often, as Kadar and Justin were talking about, kind of these different environmental issues and the communities that they're impacting. And I always think about Hurricane Maria, which kind of ran through the Caribbean a few years ago. And the immediate kind of outcry that followed that was the support for Puerto Rico, which was great and obviously very well deserved. But I also, my family, for example, is from the Virgin Islands, which is a predominantly Black string of islands. It's like 90% Black. And no one ever remembers that we're a territory of the U.S. and that we're also full of U.S. citizens who don't have voting rights, who can't vote and kind of put these infrastructures into place to better prepare themselves for these environmental disasters, and who also were without running water, who also still don't have a proper hospital, who have to fly to the States in order to get care, and all of these different things because of the environmental issues that are impacting the island, and how sometimes we become so focused on kind of the thing that's in the media, for example, with Puerto Rico. We become so focused on helping this one issue that we forget about all of the other ones simultaneously. And so I feel like that's something that, you know, I hope people keep in mind as we're going through this, that these are all, you know, really, really important issues, but these aren't the only issues that you should be tackling and the only things that you should be thinking of. And this is kind of something that you need to keep within your framework and within your thinking in all aspects of what you're looking at and what you're advocating for.
If I can say one point there, because it's this salient, the Lime Tree Bay oil refinery is in St. Croix in the Virgin Islands, right? This oil refinery was restarted recently and rained oil across the community to where people couldn't have vegetation. It polluted the water and the communities disproportionately in the Virgin Island of St. Croix are Black and lower wealth. Right. Biden's EPA just removed a key permit to sort of stop it from operating, but it was approved. And so you're 100% right that even though we're here and we're doing all these things in the States, the oil pipeline that we're trying to stop could have been shipping oil down to the U.S. Virgin Islands. And those voices of people who have been intentionally marginalized can be too easily overlooked. Based on people's proximity. And so how do we elevate those voices? And elevating those voices is going to be really important. So it's just in the last week that happened, right? And so it's a really salient point.
Thank you both for sharing your perspectives on that. Definitely important things to think about as we move through this topic. Something I want to start by highlighting is how incredibly intertwined environmental injustices are, not just to health inequity, but to literal like pharmaceutical companies and the medical industrial complex. So one example I want to give is the Bayer-Monsanto merger, which happened in 2018. So Bayer is a German pharmaceutical and chemical manufacturing company, and it acquired Monsanto for $66 billion in 2018. And so one of the products that Bayer actually acquired was Roundup, which is a glyphosate-based herbicide produced by Monsanto. So you see how this company that produces pharmaceutical drugs is buying a company that produces toxins which go into the environment and make people sick. A key example of the medical industrial complex and how, you know, industry is so intertwined with what we consider as health and also health access. And so scientific studies have shown an association between Roundup exposure and non-Hodgkin lymphoma, which is a cancer of the white blood cells in humans. A recent study from the University of Washington concluded that Roundup could increase the risk of developing non-Hodgkin lymphoma by 41%. And this cancer is disproportionately found among Latinx and Asian American and Pacific Islander communities and low-income agricultural workers. One factor being overexposure to Roundup and its toxins found in people who do agricultural work and work in that industry. In 2017, the FDA approved a drug from Bayer called Allocopa, and this is used to treat adult patients who have relapsed after at least two previous therapies for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So this is a perfect example of the violence inflicted by the medical industrial complex. You have the same company that's producing herbicides that cause cancer produce the very drug that helps people with this cancer. And Bayer also has, like every pharmaceutical company, arm of their company that works with the EPA. And the EPA repeatedly reported that glyphosates, which are the main ingredient in Roundup, do not cause carcinogens, despite the numerous studies from the World Health Organization and researchers across the country and world that it actually does lead to this cancer. Another example, the president of Mexico has issued farmers a ban on glyphosates, including Roundup, so they can't use this after 2024. And he cited, again, the World Health Organization report and Mexico's own version of the EPA reports that show the carcinogens found in Roundup. And now Bayer is having their lobbying arm put pressure on Mexico to repeal the Mexico ban in fear that workers and companies specifically in the US will stop using this because, you know, a country has stopped allowing their people to have this in their environment because of the health effects. And so you can see how a pharmaceutical company is both influencing like US foreign policy, US domestic policy, our literal health, a 41% increase in getting this rare cancer. Like, it's no coincidence. It's literally like they're producing the drug that makes you sick and then making drugs that treat that sickness. So again, environmental, like a key example of environmental injustice, one, and two, health injustice, and also how capitalism is so intertwined into the discussion that we'll be having today.
No, I appreciate your explanations of those points. And in particular, we cannot forget about the effect capitalism has on the decision-making of corporations, because the motive of a pure capitalist is economic and financial. It has no concern for who is killed on the way toward more profit shares for stakeholders. It has no concern about the persistence of poverty and exploitation of poorer folks and people without economic means. Our systems are not designed to care about the folks with cancer. Is designed to care about the people who make the money off of that. And as long as we operate in a country economically, politically, and socially that bends toward the will of those who will choose exploitation over liberation, we're going to see ourselves in this fight. And that's where raising the social consciousness and the people power is going to be so important to help alter the trajectory of our future, because capitalism in and of itself will not do that. It will be the society that changes how it interacts with capitalism.
Yeah. And speaking of capitalism, Another really big issue that we've been seeing is this industrialization and factory farming of meat and like livestock, I guess. And we know that's obviously driven by profit, by, you know, higher production margins and things like that. And so I specifically wanted to talk about pig farms and hog production in North Carolina, which has some of the largest and greatest numbers of hog factories in the country. And so basically in these hog factories, there's hundreds to over 1,000 pigs per building. And these buildings are equipped with essentially just giant fans, which blow the gas and waste out of the building into the surrounding communities. And liquid and solid waste are flushed into open lagoons that they have outside of these factories. And this lagoon water is then supposedly filtered and sprayed into the nearby fields. And the factories claim that all of this waste is kept on site and that it, you know, doesn't leak into the communities and things like that. But of course, you have rain, you have ground runoff, and, you know, groundwater reserves and things like that. And so obviously that's not necessarily the case. And you also have a state that's literally in the middle of tropical weather patterns. And so in 1999, for example, Hurricane Floyd hit North Carolina, which caused a lot of these lagoons to spill over. And you had animal feces just running in the streets, by people's homes in the nearby communities, and literally just polluting the environment. And they didn't do anything about it. And it's also completely legal to have these lagoons. All of these hog factories in North Carolina have obtained permits that allow them to do this, which is really ridiculous that it's something that's actively regulated and is done so, so poorly, which I feel like goes back to what Justin has said earlier about the fact that these are decisions that are made. These are positions that people are put into. And that, you know, the government and the people who are supposedly regulating all of these different issues, they're making these active decisions on who they're exposing and who they think is disposable. And it's not something that's happening on accident. And so there's this really great TED Talk by Steve Wang. He talks about a lot of the research that he's done around these hog factories in North Carolina specifically. And he did a study where he looked at the correlation between the pollution that hog farms cause and the health of a lot of the nearby community members. And one thing that he noted was that the majority of these communities were predominantly Black. And he specifically looked at communities that were in half a mile of anywhere between 1 to 16 hog farms. So imagine like within a mile radius of you, there's 16 of these things, spilling feces and blowing waste into the air, into your homes, where your children play, where you go to school, where you go grocery shopping. If you want to go for a run outside, anything that you want to do to better your health, you're still in this polluted environment. And so he actually tracked the levels of hydrogen sulfide in the air, which is a toxic gas that's released when feces breaks down, as well as other particulate matters in the air, and then simultaneously had the folks in the neighborhood track their own health output. So every morning and evening for 2 to 3 weeks, they would sit outside for 10 minutes, and they would rate the odor that they were smelling, which was the hydrogen sulfide, which has kind of like this rotten egg smell to it. And then once they went back inside, they would record any physical symptoms they felt, feelings of stress or anxiety, as well as how capable they were of doing their daily activities following this exposure. And then in addition to their own personal recordings, they had like actual monitors that measured their lung function and their blood pressure. And when you overlaid all of that data with the collected data based on the pollution, the community members' recordings of the odor levels, of their blood pressure, of their lung function, everything correlated almost directly with these hydrogen sulfide outputs. And so you see these graphs, which you can link to on our website, where, you know, in the morning, when the hog farm starts back up, the hydrogen sulfide levels rise, as does the odor, as this blood pressure and lung function decreases. You have a lull in the middle of the day and then it goes back up at night. And so these are very, very real health outputs that you can't, you know, you can't just shut your door and go inside and kind of ignore it. And folks reported, you know, they would go outside just to walk to their mailbox or to take their trash out, and their eyes would begin to water. They would be coughing, having trouble breathing, and all of these things. And all of these hog factories, for the most part, are most densely located in eastern North Carolina, which has the highest proportion of POC in the state, particularly Black people, and is also home to a lot of lower income communities. And so you see almost this like purposeful placement of these factories. They even noted that, I think it was around 2005, they had started to try and place these hog farms around golf courses and white neighborhoods, and that never happened, and they got a lot of pushback on it, but they never did anything about the hog farms that were already existing in these Black communities and that continue to, you know, cause all of this pollution.
Okay, can I say something? I might have a phrase mm-hmm. that is helpful or not. Mustafa Santiago Ali calls these communities that you said are being exploited with purposeful placement sacrifice zones, that there are places within our country and communities that have been designated as sacrifice zones because those people have been devalued. Their lives are only seen as disposable and expendable, but never as having value. And so the fact that these hog farms exist, the fact that these communities have been targeted for this pollution is because they are viewed as sacrifice zones. And as long as we continue to view that there are some people whose lives are more expendable than others, right, that the lives of the folks down in eastern North Carolina have less value than people who can afford country clubs and the like, right, this will continue to perpetuate amongst itself. And you're talking about with the diseases that they now have, how are they supposed to fight multi-billion dollar companies? Right? You're in and out of the hospital. Right? Those are the costs associated with this environmental injustice that's not being calculated because folks don't care. They don't see them as people. Right? It's the money that the hogs make. It's the bacon that you eat. And I watched this documentary called What the Health. You should totally watch it. It's really good. It's better than Food Inc., in my opinion. And my family watched this whole thing. And part of it was talking about these hog farms. They didn't say it, you know, with as much articulation as you did in explaining what was going on, but they had these clips of families who were dying of cancer and are like, you know, they're shooting the feces and things on Sunday and it gets all in my clothes. And so I can't go to church, things of that sort. And one man said, you know, folks, they're enjoying their meals, right? And not realizing that it's costing us our lives. In essence. And so the day after that, my family decided we were going to stop eating meat. I'm a vegetarian now. But just that idea that there are sacrifice zones and we can actually, you can have an act of resistance by not eating bacon. Go ahead, Athena.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say something that, what's his name again? Steve mentioned in his TEDx talk was kind of a similar idea that like the people who do have the privilege and the resources to not eat meat, to not, or to even just not source their meat from these factories, to buy local, to go to their local farms, their local butchers, et cetera, should. Because like you said, like us sitting down and enjoying these meals, ordering our pork chops at a fancy restaurant or whatever is literally killing people in other parts of our country and across the world in general. You know, and it's kind of us to, because it is this product of capitalism, it's up to us to, you know, reduce the demand. Because supply is reliant upon consumers. And if there's nobody to consume, then that's kind of one of the few things that can suppress these like mass industrial factories.
Yeah, exactly. And so looking at this in a little bit of a biological lens and encompassing, especially the things that Athena and Justin mentioned, I really want to look at how antibiotic use and antibiotic resistance have impacted our environment. So the next information has been adopted with the work that I've been working with Scarlett Bliss on the project of prevalence of antibiotic resistance in the environment. So it's like a short course we've been teaching for our students. And so we know that communities are disproportionately being impacted by antibiotic resistance, and overall, antibiotic resistance in the environment is kind of being honed in at meat plants, which Athena mentioned. And so what's an antibiotic, right? Let's like start there. Well, an antibiotic is a medication or a substance that kills or inhibits growth of bacteria. And so antibiotics are administered to humans and animals as a medicine to treat infection caused by disease-causing bacteria. And so because of this, the presence of antibiotics in the environment, such as like in the guts of animals like hogs or in the bodies of humans, can create this like selective pressure where for bacterial populations to basically evolve and evolve resistance to that antibiotic. And so so if a person, for example, is sick with an infection caused by these resistant bacteria, it's probably gonna be really difficult to treat them and can result in death because the more resistant bacteria, the more likely we as humans will come in contact with them. And so there's this thing called WASH, which is like the availability and access to water, sanitation, and hygiene. And that infrastructure, such as the access to clean water and basic sanitation facilities, really has been intervening in these transition pathways and reduces the prevalence of what we call diarrheal diseases, right? And so there are other communicable diseases such as like respiratory infections, which in some cases can also be mitigated using hand washing. And so these communicable diseases are also defined as infectious diseases. And so, you know, how does all this relate to antimicrobial resistance and why that matters? Well, poor WASH infrastructure leads to high rates of communicable disease and subsequent higher usage of antibiotics, right? And so given the majority of antibiotic use in the United States, specifically in the agricultural sector, we know that the highest concentrations of antibiotics are found on and around large industry of livestock farms that treat animals with antibiotics. And so high concentrations of antibiotics in these environments creates a selective pressure for resistant bacteria to spread through soil and water, and therefore in the guts of animals treated with these antibiotics, and therefore in the human gut of workers exposed to this environment on a daily basis. And so in fact, there's like a lot of studies that show that farmers who work on these in these farms have higher levels of resistant microbes in their guts than non-farm workers. And so what does this mean? This means that that the largest risk factors to exposure to resistant pathogens is proximity to these concentrated animal feeding operations. And so this can honestly often be like really dangerous and like hard work, for which like employees unfortunately are really underpaid and often not given adequate healthcare. But sadly, like those working these jobs are generally of low income status and really just depend on this work for their livelihood, despite the occupational hazards. And so statistics show that around 60% of the people working in the US meat processing plants are Black and or Latinx, and occupational contact with food animals may increase these workers and their families to exposure to like zoonotic, which basically is like a animal born resistant pathogen. And so why is this important? Well, also undermined by a history of medical racism, historically marginalized communities have higher prevalence of underlying comorbidities. And before I go further, let's try to unpack that and understand why. Well, there's like many reasons. First, like there's discrimination. So the CDC reports that including to racism, that can lead to chronic and toxic stress that shapes in social and economic factors that put some people from racial and ethnic minority groups at increased risk for, you know, various diseases such as COVID-19. There's also another issue of healthcare access utilization, where people from some racial and ethnic minority groups are more likely to be uninsured than their non-Hispanic white counterparts. There's also this thing where some racial and ethnic minority groups, and when I mention this, I'm really honing in on underrepresented people, so Black and Latinx folks. So these people may hesitate to seek care because they honestly distrust the government and healthcare systems responsible for inequities in treatment. And that's really evident, for example, in the Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis in Black males and the sterilization without people's permission. There's another addition to that, which is occupation, which I touched on, where some people who work in these settings have more chances to be exposed to the virus, like for example, like COVID-19 virus, due to like several factors such as being in close contact with public or other workers or these animals, and then not being able to work from home, and then not having paid sick days or even affording to have paid sick days or those things. Another one, sadly, is educational income and wealth gaps. And so Justin touched on this a lot too, where inequities in some in access to high quality education for some racial and ethnic minority groups can lead to like lower high school completion rates and barriers to college entrance. And so that on that starts to like, so the way our capitalistic country works and world, that not having a college degree honestly extremely limits the statistical chance of you getting like a higher paying job or a stable job. And so those folks who aren't able to get a college degree are most times limited with their job options. And that means they're less likely to leave their jobs. That puts them at higher risk for exposures to viruses. And so people in these situations like often can't afford to miss work, even if they're sick, because they don't have enough money saved up for essential items like food and other important living needs. And that's because their job is not paying them adequately. And to get paid adequately, sadly, most times you need like a college degree to get to even be deemed as qualified to do any high level, quote unquote, work. And then lastly, housing. So some underrepresented groups live in crowded conditions that make it more challenging to prevent these disease spread. And so in addition to growing and disproportionate unemployment rates for some underrepresented groups, especially during like now during COVID-19, it may lead to greater risk of eviction and homelessness and sharing of housing that leads to my next part, where we all know that living in crowded or multi-generational housing is more common in lower income status people who can't afford the living costs or increased rent prices because people are trying to gain more money and there's not this competition where lower income people are being pushed out of housing and affordable housing. And so because they're now having to like congregate in smaller spaces and more people, it increases the risk of antimicrobial resistance acquisition and transmission. So in conclusion, what does this tell us about who might be the highest risk of resistant infections in the United States? Well, as we've seen like with COVID-19 and other disease outcomes, it's like, it's really likely that low-income populations, Black, Hispanic and Latinx communities are the ones that are being targeted. And as like antimicrobial resistance is growing to be like a really serious public health threat, it's also an issue of environmental justice. And so for that reason, I think we should keep urging the scientific community to take the responsibility to characterize these risk factors. And then also for them, including medical doctors, politicians, community members, to work to ensure that disadvantaged community members don't continue to take on this impact of antimicrobial resistance, that this crisis of antimicrobial resistance that arose from a lot of environmental injustices and capitalism.
Okay, knowledge, look at you.
That's
no,
real.
I think you make a great point though. And I think it's also like, I think important again to remember, like as we've been mentioning throughout already, but that slaughterhouses and meat packaging plants and stuff don't just end up in low income neighborhoods. Like it's not like, oops, ahaha, dropped another meat packaging plant in this Black neighborhood again. Like, it's purposeful and they know who they're giving these jobs to and they know who they're exposing. And I think like when you think about, especially like these antibiotic resistant bacteria and the fact that like these are the people that are being more exposed, and you pair that with the fact that the US already distributes antibiotics at an absolutely ridiculous rate, because as we know, healthcare system trash. So we're already like, even if you go to the doctor, you're already getting a ridiculous amount of antibiotics, which is already increasing your susceptibility to contracting these like resistant bacterial strains. And then you're going to work in these environments where you're again overly exposed. You're going home, your children are overly exposed, everyone in the community is overly exposed. And so it's like this very drastic combination of what happens when you have a health system that fails you on the front end and on the back end, where they're not giving you the treatment that you deserve and they're not giving you the preventative care that you deserve. And then you have a country whose infrastructure is based so heavily on your exploitation that you're not getting like the public health care that you deserve either. And so you have all of these compounding effects. And that's why you end up with like these ridiculous gaps in life expectancy within a city, just based on race or based on neighborhood, or why you end up with these drastic differences if you live in Mississippi versus if you live in Vermont. And it's not on accident. You know, these things are placed and they're structured in a way that, like Justin said, creates these, oh my God, what were they called? Something with an S. Sacrifice zones.
Yes. Mustafa Santiago Ali. I just take credit for it.
Yeah. And so you create these sacrifice zones and then you just compound upon them, and all of our different systems work tangentially to compound upon them even more. And you get all of these really, really ridiculous outcomes. So I think that was a really great addition.
Yeah. Wait, you know, it's really crazy. I was reading how what they'll do is strategically determine where lower income people are, and specifically like Black and Latinx populations are, and then put the meat plant close by because they know that, like, oh, they might be desperate for jobs. And since they're desperate for jobs, we don't really need to have like awesome like health regulations, really offer them much pay because they'll do the job anyway, you know? And so that's really sick. And then also, yeah, like antibiotic like distribution is crazy. Like people are taking it like it's ibuprofen, and it's one because doctors are like, well, let's just give them an antibiotic without really understanding that they can build up resistance in these patients. But also, like, there's also a lot of research on how in lower income countries and middle income countries, where there's like this, like, also this is where the scientific community has failed them. There's like this lack of education on how you use antibiotics. And so it's like a lot of times it'll just be given over the counter. Like it's, again, like it's ibuprofen, but, and it's like strategic because they don't really care about these people. So they're like, yeah, whatever, take it. You know, so you honed in on a lot of important information.
And use the right word there, Eva. It's exploitation. The sacrifice zones, which do credit to Mustafa Santiago Ali, right, is because we have chosen to exploit certain communities for the benefit of other people, other companies, gain. And that exploitation, you articulate it so well. In each of these points of how they intersect within one another, and who ends up most affected or impacted. It's the descendants of enslaved folks, it's Latinx folks, it's indigenous populations. So appreciate that.
Yeah, and not to be doomsday-y, but since we talk about real facts here, the rise of like these antibiotic resistant bacteria and related diseases is most definitely going to rise with climate change and the effects that climate change will have on our environment. And like we've been saying throughout this episode, the communities that will be most disproportionately affected are low-income communities, Black, Latinx, and Indigenous. And we have, well, maybe not so much now, but we've had in the past like climate change deniers as world leaders. And even today, even though, like, you know, our current president has shown improvement, I don't even know, I just can't talk about presidents anymore, but like even though our president is not a climate change denier, like the amount of money we invest into studying the effects of climate change, the amount of money we invest into preventing the effects of climate change is like, it's not going to save us, and it's not going to save the communities that live on the coast and that rely on these agricultural jobs. So yeah, it's like we're constantly digging ourselves into a major hole. And then when disaster strikes, like the government's like, why? Like, why did things get so bad? It's exactly what happened with COVID, exactly what happens with every single hurricane, the exact reason why there was a whole power outage for a week in some areas in the South, a week and longer. And so the more that we like continue to divest from science, both socially and infrastructure wise, the worse that these issues will get for the most underserved communities.
That's the thing though, the people who had the least to do with any of this, right, receive the least amount of benefit, will pay the most cost. It's like, where is the justice? where is the democracy in that? Where is the ideals, right? Like they seem to be non-existent when you talk about the real ramifications. It's going to be the poor. It's going to be the marginalized. And they had nothing. They didn't get any benefit from that hog, right? They got none of the benefit from the oil. They didn't make billions. They didn't make millions, as so many people will, off of the suffering. But they're going to inherit the ramifications of that down the line. And their children will. And their children's children will. And somehow we've become okay with it. And everybody should be angry. Like to be, what is it, Baldwin, relatively conscious, and a Negro in America is to be angry all the time? Right? Like we have to be angry because people are dying who will never get on podcasts like this one, right? Who will never go to universities or colleges like the ones many of us have been privileged to go to. And they're dying and being suffocated by toxins. And too many people of privilege and means, particularly those who are white, are okay with it because the comforts of their life are more important than the creatures God created to live fully and wholly in human beings.
Whew, I feel like I just went to church. Wow. Yeah, this is definitely a lot. Yeah, I don't like, you're really not human if you're not angry all the time, I feel like, at this point, especially after everything we've seen these past few years. But Justin, I think that's a great like introduction into kind of you taking over and talking about your work and sharing some of the experiences and perspectives that you have from being like directly on the ground fighting against environmental injustice and with your community.
Sure. And again, I appreciate this opportunity. Down here in Memphis and more regionally and across the country, the fight is picking up. And we are really excited that the voices of people who have been marginalized and who have been told that they are voiceless are now becoming the megaphone for environmental justice in this country. So we have a billion-dollar company, two of them, Valero Energy Corporation and Plains All American, who are seeking to bring oil from Oklahoma through our community in northern Mississippi down to the Gulf of Mexico for export. They're seeking to do this by crossing the Memphis Sand Aquifer, which supplies drinking water to over 1 million people, not only in Memphis, but in northern Mississippi and some of our other neighbors as well. They're seeking to do this by building that pipeline atop the most seismically active area in the southeastern part of the United States. And they're misusing the laws of eminent domain to take people's property, especially and including some Black folks' property who didn't have access to buying land at the time that their family members purchased it in the early 1900s. So we are facing one of the most important and significant cases of environmental injustice and environmental racism in our nation. And it is because of this perpetual exploitation. I can tell you this, in Boxtown and in Westwood, there are over 17 toxic release inventory facilities. So when we're talking about chemicals being sprayed into the air by oil refineries and steel mills, and for 60 years it was coal, the folks who were breathing that air, we're in a community that's 97% African-American and Black, with the average income for those who work of about $26,000 a year. 96% of the pollution of toxic chemicals in this county are in one zip code. Those are not accidents, right? To Athena's point and what we've talked about here today, those are intentional choices and decisions to say, there are some people's lives who are expendable here. And so for them, we don't need to give them anything other than the pollutants that other parts of the city do not want. And this oil pipeline, this crude oil pipeline, is only a continuation of that history, but they run into Memphis at a different point in time in history where we know a little bit more about the environment. We know a little bit more about the law, and we know a little bit more about ourselves and our posterity and the importance of fighting.
Wow. So can you talk a little bit about forming like the Memphis Community Against the Pipeline group and how that came together and what challenges and successes y'all have had?
Sure. So Memphis Community Against the Pipeline was actually born on October 17, 2020. And it's an interesting date because that was the day that the pipeline company held a community meeting down in Southwest Memphis. And their expectation was that they would explain to the community how good this pipeline was going to be, how many jobs temporary would be created, and how much money they would be given to the community, $1 million in philanthropy and $500,000 in taxes. And that because they were going to do those few things, we should accept them and adopt them and allow for them to build this pipeline, regardless of what other ramifications that there could be. But what really happened, there was the movement was born. Community member after community member got up saying, we don't need this and we don't want it. We have too much fossil fuel infrastructure. We have too many things that are quite literally killing us, and we do not want to add to that. And so that day, myself and the co-founders, Kizzy Jones and Kathy Robinson, and my family as well, agreed that we would fight. And so we got in touch with community association leaders and other organizers in the community and said, hey, tell us what you know about this pipeline and what we should be doing and who we should be talking with. And it is the power of collective action. But to get to collective action, I think you need two things. You need collective memory and you need collective work. And so the first thing for us was memory. What has happened that we do not know? Over the last 2-3 years of this pipeline trying to get inside of our community. And so we listened to the stories and how they came into the communities and they went on people's land without their permission and how they organized meetings that were all on weekdays so that folks couldn't attend except for one, which forced them to have another meeting because people had so many questions on that Saturday meeting. Also heard the stories of some landowners like Scotty Fitzgerald, who talked about 20 people she knew dying of cancer in the community. And that collective memory is so important to have and to ground oneself in this work. And then it is going to be collective work. I have the privilege of being a spokesperson for the organization. And so I do interviews and I do wonderful podcasts like this one. And the truth of the matter is, it is never going to be one person that is going to come to any resolution for 1 million people. That's just not how it's going to work. It is going to be folks who are really passionate, folks who are willing and able to dedicate the time. And I'll hearken on that point just a second. It's a privilege to be able to dedicate the time to this movement. I work a full-time job that allows me a certain amount of flexibility. Where I have benefits and I can take vacation and I can take personal days. And so there's a privilege that I am hoping to exercise on behalf of people who are not privileged as I am. And for people who have social locations such as myself, we have to, as I have learned, choose a social location different from our own in order to be proximate to the people who are suffering the most, in order that we might change the systems that, if changed, would benefit everyone and liberate more people. After that October meeting, we started to meet 2, 3, 4 times a week until we knew as much as we possibly could about this pipeline. And after learning as much as we could, we knew that it wasn't enough. We had to get in the community and notify people. We had to inform. We had to let them know that this pipeline is coming to take advantage of us and they're going to risk all of our drinking water and they're going to take people's land. And we had to educate them that our drinking water is precious. Memphis is the largest city in the entire United States of America to get all of its drinking water from the ground through an aquifer, the largest municipality in the country. It's the most, you can drink the water out of the faucet, no problem. Largest municipality in the world where that happens. And we know that the protective layer between us, you would say, and the drinking water has holes in it or breaches. And so we had to educate people and say, they're trying to build the pipeline through an area that has breaches in the clay layer. And so when an oil spill occurs, hydrogeologists learn that you can spill 1 pound of crude oil into that water, and it's going to contaminate 25 million gallons of water, just 1 pound. And they're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds per day going through this pipeline to risk our drinking water. So we had to educate people about the dangers of what's going on and what could happen if we chose to do nothing. And then we had to activate folks. Having all of the information and the education is nothing if we do not actively work to create change and to create justice in our neighborhoods and in our community. And so that's what we did. We had a meeting in December, and it was a community organized meeting. And we said, everybody just come and speak about what you feel, what you think. And they did. I mean, during COVID, we had 60 people socially distanced in the park. And maybe 15 to 20 folks spoke, and the last person to speak was Marie Odom. Never forget the speech. And she walks up to the mic, and she has papers in her hands, and she says, Bihaley has sent these papers to my dad, and they're trying to take his land that he's been caring for since he was 16 years old. He keeps up the property. It looks like a park, and we need help. And I'm just here to say we need help. And I need y'all to know we in this together. That's what she said. She ends her speech. Afterwards, I meet Clyde Robinson and Marie Odom. We're at this point, this very small group who have very few means. And I said, we're going to help you. And before you go to court next, we're going to get you an attorney, and it's going to be all right. We're going to fight this thing. Now, I'm a deeply spiritual person, and so I think that's where all that came from. But if you are not spiritual, you're just like, you lied to her, and you would not be wrong. What happened between that meeting and our next one in January is Birch Porter and Johnson said, we're going to take on her case pro bono. And we found another person, Scotty Fitzgerald, and they said, we're going to take her case on pro bono too. We built a coalition of people here in Memphis, Protect Our Aquifer, who had been deeply concerned about our drinking water, the Tennessee chapter of the Sierra Club, a group out in Oregon, Breach Collective as well. All got together and said, okay, let's fight. And so we started to appeal decisions legally. They were given a permit by Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation. We're appealing that. They were given a permit by the administration, our U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. We asked our congressman to write a letter to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and has since written a letter to President Biden to rescind that. And we're even getting in touch with people, Escadar knows, in the Biden-Harris administration to get that permit rescinded so that community input can be a core proponent of getting permission to build this pipeline. And right now, you don't need the community's input at all. Heck, if you are a landowner with the pipeline on your yard, you don't even have to tell your neighbor, or the company doesn't even have to tell your neighbor that there's going to be a crude oil pipeline, although we know the negative ramifications for the property values. I'll fast forward a little bit because I want to hear what other questions you have. But we built people power, that informing and that educating had significant impact. And our numbers of tens and dozens went to hundreds and now into the thousands of supporters who are deeply concerned about this pipeline project and about our drinking water and about the folks in 38109, this beautiful Black resilient community that's also lower wealth and has been created that way, as we've talked about before. And so our politicians started to get more engaged as we continued to hound them, phone banking and email banking, and encouraging them in very deliberate ways to be involved and engaged, or we were going to have to take more serious civic action toward them. And that has paid off in a lot of ways to raise this issue to local and national prominence, right? We have been fortunate that our entire city council in just the last few weeks all voted to oppose the Bihaley pipeline. They passed a reading of an ordinance to protect our drinking water, which right now is unprotected. Recently, the Shelby County Commissioners denied the sale of two parcels of land to the pipeline company, saying, no, we're not going to support this effort. And it's important that people know, on the last one in particular, the fact that we were able to stop the sale of that land was because a regular citizen, not even a core team member of MCAP, watched the commission meeting, learned about the sale of the land, told a county commissioner who we had pre-scheduled a meeting with, who was able to tell us, right? Like, everybody can be an activist. Everybody can engage in the fight. There is room for every single person. And that is the power that we have. All you got to do is find something, touch something. Injustice is around you. And that has been an important lesson for us on this journey, because we want as much engagement as possible. And you're sending an email individually might not seem to make a difference. But if there are 3,999 other people who are also sending that email, now we have power. Now we are building a movement. And that's been recognized. We had Danny Glover tweeting about Memphis Community Against the Pipeline. Vice President Al Gore tweeted about Memphis Community Against the Pipeline and then accepted an invitation to come to Memphis, Tennessee. And he spoke at a rally that we held, and he called the pipeline what it is, racist, reckless ripoff. And you bring a Nobel Peace Prize winning Vice President of the United States of America into a community that makes $26,000 a year, that has 17 of these toxic release inventory facilities, and something is happening. And we believe that although we have a lot of challenges ahead to win, they do not feel insurmountable as they once did.
Yeah, that's all. Wow. I'm still thinking about in the beginning when you're talking about kind of the introduction of the pipeline, when you said that they were giving $1 million in philanthropy and 500,000 in taxes, and that was somehow supposed to be enough for people's lives. Like, that just really, like, baffles me that they even thought that was something they could put a price tag on, you know? But I guess I'm just curious kind of what, you know, folks can do who aren't, you know, in the community. Like, what can we do from outside to support y'all and y'all's movement and your struggle, you know?
Yeah. One, I appreciate the question. And yeah, you can really learn where a company's values are by looking at the numbers. When they first started this project, they were planning to make $21 million a day, which calculates to about $7.66 billion per year. $7.66 billion per year. And they gave $1 million in philanthropy, right? And they're paying for people's property for as little as less than $100 in some cases, while they plan to make tens of billions over the next several years throughout the life of this pipeline. This structure, as we currently operate in capitalism, is of exploitation, and it is harmful, and it is hurtful, and is demeaning to people's very essence as human beings. And the perpetuation of this history is what we're living through and people are experiencing every single day here in Memphis. And we got to say something, and we got to do something to stop it. And it's time to make history and not continue to be impacted by the negative portions of history, but instead inherit that struggle that many people have fought for. And everybody can do that. As I shared before, you can be an activist in this movement for environmental justice in Memphis. You can go to memphiscap.org, join the movement, take action. We need folks to join our volunteer team over the next weeks, launching on Dr. King's assassination date, like April 4th here in Memphis, through April 20th, we are going to have in action every single day, activism in April. And we're going to need people sending emails consistently. We're going to need folks phone banking and helping to educate and inform our community. And if you have some extra time to be able to do that for an hour or two, a couple days out of the week, remember, right, a lot of the folks in our neighborhoods, they are oftentimes working, and so they may not have that extra time to invest in volunteering. And so if you do have that, now is the time to say, because I realize oppressed people are being oppressed actively in a way that takes away their opportunity to be civically engaged, I will take on some of that civic engagement in order to help advance the cause of those very people who I care about. And so we need folks to email our city councilors and encourage them to vote to protect Memphis's drinking water. and to continue opposing the pipeline. And again, you can find all of their emails at memphiscap.org and take action. It is not insignificant. Those tweets, those emails, and tell them where you're from. You don't have to be from Memphis, like even me. Wherever you're from, you can tell them that and that you care, because this isn't just Memphis's issue. If this happens in Memphis, just like as it happened in Flint, it can happen in any of our communities, especially communities that are communities of color and of lower wealth.
I just have this really minor detail, but I think it's just crazy how, like in Flint, correct me if I'm wrong, but it first impacted people of color, especially underrepresented people. Now it's like impacting everyone, and now everyone cares. And it's just kind of, I don't know, to me, just like really frustrating to hear how they don't care until like everybody's impacted. And by everybody, they really mean people, especially white people. And so it's like, it's just really frustrating to see how like evident it is of like whose lives matter more. And like the fact that there's even like this spectrum of which life matters more than the other person, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, our movement has gained momentum, particularly because it would impact everyone. If this was only an issue for people in Southwest Memphis who are majority African-American, it is very unlikely that it would have gained as much prominence as it has. Because at this point, things must impact white people in order for it to matter on a significant enough scale, unless it has to do with the lynching of Black people. But we're talking about the living of Black people, which is harder for folks to really grapple with, because they then have to realize their own complicity or implicity within systems and structures that benefit them and not others. And so we hold these tensions within our movement by prioritizing our community of Southwest Memphis and of Black people, while recognizing the larger issues that would impact everyone, and not losing our own people in that conversation. That even if this pipeline is built, and we don't think it will be, the folks who are going to be able to drink bottled water are not the folks in the community that's going to be most directly impacted by the pipeline.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point you both brought up. I was really close to like Newark, New Jersey, which also has a really bad water crisis, and it like nobody ever spoke about it. And now that, you know, Newark is starting to be gentrified, white people, wealthier people are beginning to move into the city, suddenly it's in the news, suddenly the protests are being covered, suddenly people care that North Jersey hasn't had clean water in God knows how long, particularly Newark hasn't had clean water. And it's like, I don't know, it's like almost like they don't expect us to notice why they're suddenly caring. And I think that's a really good point you bring up, is that like, in order for people to care, it has to affect everyone. But regardless of whether or not people care, the people that it's going to affect the most are going to stay the same. Mm-hmm. And those are the people who, like you said, like don't have the privilege to change their circumstance. Mm-hmm.
And like that's, it's an ineffective model to get to liberation. There's no way that we continue to operate with the mentality of something has to directly impact me, because we will never get free that way. Right. I'm talking with three extraordinary, beautiful women of color. Right. If I am not deeply concerned about the fact that you make or will make on average significantly less in wages compared to white men, Black men, or white women. Right. Like how then can I deeply care about you as a person? Right. Like if I am not concerned that a Black woman is three times more likely to die giving childbirth than her white counterpart, right? How then can I truly care about you living and being free? I can't. And so I'll never give birth, right? But I must be able in some way, shape, or form to choose the social location of people who are being marginalized, right? Like my failure to do so, or to say, well, if it doesn't impact me, then I don't have to care, right? Will always leave someone at the bottom. And instead, like if we are going to get free, white folks are going to have to say, regardless of if it impacts me directly, it impacts me indirectly. Because no thing that happens has zero impact on me, which is why if Black folk ain't free and poor folk ain't free and houseless folks ain't free, you ain't free either. Even if you're not those things. And so it's a paradigm shift truly needed that can start with this idea of universality of suffering. But it really must become more specific and more much more proximate to a person, right? It is Marcella Shepherd in Boxtown who won't be able to grow greens like her grandmama taught her, right? And that's not fair. And she's being mistreated. And so I care about her as a human being. And thus I will advocate alongside her.
I remember I started to take a lot of notes when you talked about like your tactics on community organizing, which I feel like are always important because I feel like the more intentional you are and like you know you can make more shit happen, you know?
Yeah.
And like so like I haven't I think the collective memory is something I have not really I've done maybe a little bit, but I didn't do it. I don't know. Maybe I'm not doing it intentionally, you know? So that was like really interesting, but Eskara, what do you think? Is that, you feel like that's
relevant? No, I definitely think that's important. Like, I feel like a lot of what we talk about can be high level sometimes, and grounding this in like, you know, people who are doing work on the ground and their perspectives is definitely important.
Mm-hmm. Like how can like community members effectively community organize against environmental racism? And then I don't know why, but I'm kind of thinking like make it pointed towards privileged people to do the labor. I don't know.
Yeah.
I feel like underrepresented people like could probably do it better, like they know more or whatever, but I don't know. I feel like privileged people need to know that they can do it and they should be doing it.
Yeah,
they should be playing major roles, especially with their access to resources is what I keep thinking about, you know?
No, that's exactly
right. I have like a connected question, I guess, that goes with that. But you had mentioned earlier you were like platforming and how the people who have platforms like us sitting here, like we have degrees to my knowledge. And like you have three of us at least.
I did. My parents were literally handed me.
But I'm like, we have these certain degrees of privilege. Like, yes, we're all Black, and we may come from these different communities, but like we, you know, we've done these certain things that give us this power and that give us this platform and give us this ability to like sit here and have this conversation, to even have the time to sit here and have this conversation. So I guess with that, like with you know, elevating community voices, how can we like, yeah, how do we do that? How do we platform the people who are closest to the issue, who have the most to lose and also the most to gain, you know?
Everybody can be an activist, which means everyone can be activated towards social change if they choose an issue that they want to have an impact on. For anyone in a community that is looking to create that social change, I think there are some deliberate steps that they can take. One, find out the issues that they care about and who's working on it. I assure you, in every community, there are people who are working on what you are concerned about, whether that be pollution, whether that be poverty, whether that be mass incarceration. And so find an organization where you can put your energy and time and effort to support that work. It may be volunteering for 1 hour to make phone calls. It may be sending emails. It may be being the executive assistant to a loan executive director who's just trying to figure things out. And so get proximate to an organization and a group that is trying to do some of this work. Then I think you really do want to do more education on the issue while you work, sometimes simultaneously, because if you're fighting a pipeline like we're fighting, we don't really have a lot of time to stop. And so doing the personal education and community education with the group that you're a part of or that you are starting is going to be really important. And then you need to look at where you need to exercise your levers of power. Who is responsible for getting you the desired outcome that you want or your group wants? Is that the President of the United States? Is that the governor? Is that the city council members or the county commissioners or the school board of education or the director of environment locally? Find out where those power centers are and build your strategy around people power development and neighborhood coalition building and organization coalition building around that desired outcome. And you can use the amount of people that you have to influence the ultimate decision makers to help you get to a more desirable outcome. We have not won this fight, and there's a lot more that we have to do. But at this point, those are some of the key steps that I think we have taken that have helped us to be successful in these small ways. And we're up against a multi-billion, two multi-billion dollar crude oil pipeline company operators. And so we're going to have to continue to hone these skills and improve upon them as a team, myself, Kathy, Kizzy, and the group, in order that we might get to the desired outcome that we wish to have. Kathy and Kizzy, my co-founders, are also Black women. And so no movements happen without Black women. And so join a group that has Black women actively participating in it. And is really important for people who have means and resources to join these fights. A lot of people of color are exhausted by living because living is exhausting, particularly in the United States of America, with its roots and its foundations and its perpetuation of oppression and inequality and racism. And so if you are white and you are of privileged means, you need to be not necessarily on the front lines, but right behind the people on the front lines, giving financial resources, giving strategic resources, providing time, pro bono to efforts that are happening in the community. Truly, if we can get the folks who are being most oppressed free, it will free all of us. And so if you think you are free, then this lesson is for you. You are not. And you need to find the folks who are being obviously, for your own sake, oppressed and join the communities in this struggle. And there are a lot of ways that people can use power and privilege, including folks who have some form of post-secondary education, whether you went to a good school like Bowdoin or elsewhere. You have an opportunity to use those connections and what you've learned to also contribute to the community struggle and the community's fight by elevating the voices of people who are on the front lines. Case in point, me being on this podcast now, right? It is, oh, I see someone doing something cool in the fight for justice. That intersects with things that I am passionate about or that I care about. And so someone like Escadar reaches out and says, hey, let's talk, right? And let's elevate the struggle of the people in Memphis. Right? We can do that for one another based on our proximity to each other. And again, everyone can be an activist and no one is powerless. All of those are constructs that literally have ramifications in our ability to fight or willingness to fight because of how society has treated us over the past few centuries. When you have education, but when you have been invited to certain networks, it is an obligation, in my opinion, to use those networks and that power for good. So use it. If you know CEOs who are willing to fund grassroots organizers and you're working with a small organization, then you need to connect with the CEO. If you have friends who are videographers or photographers who can take pictures of your movement in order that you can send that to donors, then you ought to be doing that, right? Like, we cannot segment justice from like our personal and our professional and our other lives. It is an ability, right? Because freedom, it is not just the ability to be free in one relationship or in one setting. It is to live that way holistically. And so the messages that you would post advocating for your cause should go on your personal Instagram and your Twitter and your Facebook and your LinkedIn too. Like, that's how people of privilege and people of means can really join movements in a first kind of safe way, but also with the responsibility to deepen that engagement as they learn more. Athena, Eve, did that answer your questions or no?
Yes, that was beautiful. Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. I feel like that's a really good way to close, right, Jessica?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I feel like we're going to be listening to you / reading through this podcast repeatedly. You're dropping.
Yeah, I feel so enlightened.
Yeah.
Y'all too funny.
We're like texting each other, like, okay, first of all, how
they're like, oh my god,
so fluently. Like, how? I remember Athena was just like, he says some shit that he's like, fact. So you can't say I'm wrong.
Literally.
That is true.
No, this has been so great.
Y'all are a trip. This has been fantastic. I am honored and privileged and humbled by the opportunity, but even more so by the enlightenment that I was able to achieve in listening to y'all explain and teach and educate and inform me and some things that I didn't know as much about. And so I am grateful that our spirits and our bodies have connected for this time together.
Wow.
That was so beautiful.
Yeah, no, I can't thank you enough, Justin, for joining us and sharing your time and your personal experiences too. And yeah, we'll definitely plug MCAP everywhere on our socials. Continue on from there.
Ooh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you. This is wonderful. I feel like I've learned so much. And like Esther said, we'll also be reading through this transcript for like ever. So thank you for sharing your time and your knowledge and, you know, all the things.
Thank you. And
literally. Oh, wait, go ahead, please.
There's going to be a pretty detailed report coming out by the NAACP on April Fool's Day about pipeline foolery. And another article is being written by a reporter that we're pretty close with. That'll be fun. I don't know where you post things, but this organization.
We have like a resources page, so I'll definitely add that there.
Thank you again, Justin, so much for taking time to speak with us today and for providing incredible knowledge and perspectives on issues of environmental injustice and specifically the work that you're doing in Memphis. To learn more about Memphis Community Against the Pipeline and how you can be more involved in helping the community fight against the Byhalia Pipeline, you can visit memphiscap.org and plug into the action items that they have listed. We'll also be including resources on the various initiatives that Justin mentioned, as well as the studies that we've detailed relating to environmental injustice on our website, donoharmhrk.wordpress.com. And our transcripts will also be linked on our website. Thank you all so much for tuning in, and we hope you'll join us for our next episode.